I get up early in the mornings. Maybe I never quite finish time shifting back from Vienna. I'm usually up around 4. And today I spent the time producing a figure that's probably going to be helpful to you. So it's now the most recent thing posted on the Catalyst site, this last item here. Hopkins 16 Figure 1 Version 4 PDF is this. Hopkins 16 is an essay I'm writing. And this is just, in one picture, a comparison of the two distributions we were talking about a week ago. The standard Procrustes and this thing I'm calling the integrated version or the deflated Procrustes. We're using both words, and you don't have to worry about the math for this course. The top set of forms really is a sample from the standard Procrustes distribution of shape on a 6x6 grid. You can see this is 6 rows and 6 columns. Don't use a pen on the white screen, sorry. And you can also see up that this is a sample of forms that pretty much all have the same Procrustes length. That's this interval here. This is a Procrustes length, about 0.12 to 0.14. And so they all have the same probability of having come from a starting perfect grid. The point to be made by looking at that set of 10 forms is that is not going to be likely from a biological sample. Yep.
These forms don't just have landmarks around the outside. The entire, every grid.
There's 36 landmarks there.
Yeah, every point in the grid is a separate landmark.
That's not a thin plate spline. That's just connecting the landmarks with their neighbors. That's not a spline. It's not smooth. But the point is, you wouldn't see biological data that looks like that. These changes that are being modeled as independent at every pair of landmarks, however close together they are, that's not how organisms work. It would be how Brownian motion works. If these were 36 particles that started in a square on your microscope slide, and you waited a couple of minutes for them to diffuse out, these are all valid patterns of diffusion for that set of 36 pollen grains on a microscope slide. But our models aren't models of growth, evolution, disease aren't diffusions. So that's the Procrustes probability model, and that's why I've been saying for the last several lectures it isn't very useful in biology. On the bottom is the modification that I'm now pushing in the book and in the selections you've got and in these articles from 2015 and 2016 and in a whole bunch of talks. These transformations down here at the bottom have the same Procrustes length as the transformations at the top. They were selected from an assortment of 100 to have the same total bending. But you can see that while these kind of leave the starting square alone, these start to look like what we showed in last lecture were the largest scale partial warp there. This is a square to a trapezoid, and this is something like a square to a kite. The diagonal is moving. At the same time, you can also see the emergence of smaller scale changes. There's a little crumpling here, something funny going on. Sorry, where was it? Over there. Something local over here. Your eye is processing this distribution correctly in pulling out the fact that these features are roughly discrete from scale to scale. And they just don't exist up here. You don't see discrete features, you just see something funny at every set of, at every square, every set of grids. There's a technical way of checking this. The shape distribution of little squares here and big squares is different, and the shape distribution here of little squares and big squares is actually precisely the same. So this is the systematist's dream, the bottom set. A collection of images that correspond to a set of possible characters at every scale, at every location. And that's basically the ground for my main objection to the use of the Procrustes metric, the Procrustes distance, as a model for not having a pattern. It's not a very good model for having a pattern. That's the problem. Yeah.
So
this is new to Joe. So
it, yes, and I think it's encouraging. But the bottom distribution, which is looks more real biologically, has the property that neighboring things are correlated.
Right.
In some particular...
correlated with a very specific correlation.
Very specific correlation. Is there either the existence or hope of a version of Procrustes incorporating those
it's
correlations?
Coming in today's lecture.
Great. Yeah, I will look forward to it.
It's called Relative Intrinsic Warps, and it will be our last example. And it is the subject of my 2015 paper, which is pretty technical.
Which I obviously didn't
read. You have, you probably didn't read it, and no one in the class should read it. I want to make another point, which is just that this is not quite a trivial amount of programming. This is what I had to do this morning from 4 to about 8 to get this to work. And that's a reasonable amount of typing for a teaching example. And in this case, unlike what's usually the case in our analyses, the stuff that actually does the Procrustes and the deflated Procrustes is half the total. This is the graphics, and it's only half. And this is the computation of the Procrustes distribution and the deflation, which is about 8 lines, is shrinking and then the selecting. So this is not trivial as programming. And nobody's expecting you to do it. Rather, if you got some reason to want to do this kind of analysis, get back to me, and I'll set up the code to be copied into R for you. I'm not expecting anybody here to do this by themselves. I can send you that. I can send you this text if you want, but no one here has claimed to be an R jock. So you're not grad students in statistics. There's a reason for that. A grad student in statistics could be sent this text and be told to go do it. Grad students in biology, that's not a reasonable use of your time.
They're better at R than I expect.
Than you are?
Certainly than I am. No problem there.
I shouldn't finish your sentences for you. Yeah. Okay, good. So this is roughly how, this is part 3 of a text file, so this is about 50 lines, and this isn't trivial. It is, however, I think pretty persuasive. This is figure 1 of a paper that I'm probably going to be finishing up in the next week or so. So is it now clearer what I mean by local versus global features? These don't have any global features. Everything is local in a meaningless way. These do have global features. The big square, the 6x6 outside of the square, is changing its shape, like to a kite here. Or here, you can see the diagonal moving with respect to the other diagonal, and there are still local phenomena. And to answer something Joe didn't quite ask, this distribution is unique. If you really want the shape distribution of small squares and big squares to be the same, so that when you're looking for a pattern, when you're looking for a character, you get to decide, yes, it really exists at this scale. If that's what you want to be looking for, this is the only distribution that doesn't have those. This is the only characterless distribution for morphometrics.
What did you call it? It's a something or other Procrustes.
Deflated Procrustes.
Deflated.
Yeah, because you can see here. Well, you can believe that you could see here, with a little practice, that I'm taking the warp components we talked about last lecture, and multiplying each one by this square root that my mouse is on, which is a number less than 1. And the smaller scale of phenomenon, the smaller that multiple is. So I'm deflating small scale things before producing the simulation. But we have a lot more of these small scale possibilities. There are a lot of more small squares than big squares. Only 1 big square, but 25 small squares. And this perfectly cancels in terms of looking for features. Okay. Okay, so that's the new posting here. For the rest of today, which is my last scheduled lecture, although I'll be here for three more of the days, I've got a bunch of stuff to touch on to show you why it's here, any of which you might want to go into in more detail from the text, if it's relevant to the example you're working for your course report or for anything else you're doing. So we just about got a little bit into this at the end of the last lecture. This is the thing called the uniform component, which we started in section 5.2 when we were talking about shape changes of triangles. If you only have three landmarks, then what you put on as a picture of the transformation takes a square grid into a grid that's all the same parallelograms. We saw that explicitly over here yesterday when I did this for three landmarks. And these are all uniform transformations. Oops. These are all uniform transformations. They take squares into all the same parallelogram, regardless of the size of the square. Big square goes into a big parallelogram, little squares go into little parallelograms. You can't rotate this, but you can certainly scale it. So those are uniform transformations, and the others, oops, the other kind is not uniform, the ones that actually bend this thing. Now, if a transformation is uniform, then you get to describe it using those very simple descriptors we had in section 2. Just, it's a circle into an ellipse, so basically it's just one pair of directions perpendicular. One has the greatest rate of length of change, rate of change of length, one has the least. So knowing that a transformation is almost uniform very much simplifies your report. So going back here, we take our growing rats that we were talking about a bit, and we look around, pretty much any set of triangles will do. I'm on the wrong page here, because all of these are an approximation, a graphical approximation of a global computation. But if all of your triangles, or almost all of your triangles, have pretty much the same principal axes, here's the one of maximum growth, triangle 1, triangle 2, triangle 3, triangle 4, triangle 5, those heavy dashed lines are pretty much all the same direction. And in fact, their magnitudes of strain are all pretty much the same. This is an exception, and it's an exception. It's doing something different there. But these five triangles, which represent seven of the landmarks, seem to be close to uniform. That's for the first 7 days we studied, when the rat skull is mostly growing because the rat brain needs room. If you look at the rest of the growth gradient, these directions are basically all over the place. They rotate over almost 45 degrees, which is as far as they can. And so this isn't going to be a particularly uniform transformation, although ironically the exceptional part looks the same. But these all look different. We need a technology for talking about this a little more objectively, and that technology comes, to no one's surprise, from the thin plate spline. So here's the grid for that first transformation. And if you look at this carefully enough, you can see that, yes, something is going on between those points. The grid is being expanded a little there. But there's a uniform part that gets a relative Procrustes length. Here it's 83%. This is precisely uniform. This is close to approximately uniform. And this isn't. Its uniform part is only 50%, and that's because it's getting shorter. It's being squashed. And squashing is a uniform transformation, but clearly something besides squashing is going on here. This is getting longer, faster than this is getting longer, and those points are still moving apart over here. So you could describe this quite simply as what the brain is making the skull do, and you can't expect such a simple description here. And this is a guide to how you write up the finding, not how you draw it. This is a thin plate spline, this is a thin plate spline.
Same program, same different parts of the data, but your language, your biology is different because this one is so much more simple, so much more nearly simple than this. If you like the idea that this should be a uniform transformation, then you can ask, and this is again just another R program, what are its directions? It has to have two of them. And here's all 8 points, the closest fit to a uniform, and its direction of fastest growth is this way, taken as a whole set, and its direction of slowest growth is this. And if you go back to the picture, you discover that's a good average of all of these dashed lines and an average of all of those solid lines. It's a very strangely kind of weighted average. But we knew this wasn't, this last triangle here where my mouse is, wasn't actually part of this picture, so we can ask, get rid of that landmark, it's gone now, and do this whole thing again. And we get pretty much the same directions, but now their difference in magnitude is greater. We have a better summary by restricting the uniform component only to the part that's really uniform. Instead of growing by 24%, now it grows by 25%. Instead of minimum growth being 14%, it's only 13%. So the figure for directionality, it's the ratio of these, has switched from 10% to 12%. So your report is a lot stronger once you actually looked at this picture to say, oh, the deviation from the spline, from the uniform spline, is concentrated here. Let me tell the reader what happens if I just leave that out. But of course, you can't just leave it out. You have to tell the reader you've just left it out. You have to present both analyses. This isn't cheating. This is explaining.
So, Fred, I know that you're omitting one triangle.
Which is the landmark I'm omitting is on the tip of the triangle.
Okay, so you're omitting one point, and then
omitting one point.
Okay.
And this isn't an algorithmic scientific analysis.
No,
this is a strategy for producing the report that has the more informative numbers.
Thank you.
So you do this if it works, and you say explicitly that you found the part of the landmarks here, 7 out of 8, that is participating in the uniform transformation. And here's the transformation that it's participating in. Okay. And that's all I want to say here about uniform components, except every transformation has one, and sometimes they're informative. Especially if you're doing biomechanics, if what's going on is being forced by a fluid pressure, like the brain is essentially a fluid for this purpose, or a stress, like a lever arm or a locomotion. Often you see these patterns. The evolution of the scapula can show you that the orangutan is a brachiator because of the pattern of strains that the orang scapula is designed to handle. That one hangs, gibbons hang, gorillas and chimpanzees knuckle walk, and we stand up straight and lecture. Okay, next topic, semi-landmarks. This again has a lot of associated R code, but it's in most of the packages, like Geomorph and I think it's in MorphoJ, and it's in Morpheus. So you don't have to program this. Oh, you'll also get this from TPS, Rolf's package. We had curves in that human data we were originally talking about. Here's those landmarks, the black points, with the curves as they were originally drawn. And this is just a colored picture with each form a different color. Because this is hard to draw otherwise. So you just use color. And data like this, it turns out you can use everything you already heard about, and also this deflated distribution. You can use everything with the information from the curves as well. All you have to do is sort of line up the way you sample the curves, as in this right-hand picture, so that every curve is represented by the same number of points in the same relationship to the Procrustes mean. Meaning, each point here comes from a thin plate spline, of the Procrustes mean of all these points, which we'll see in a minute.
I think there's a picture of that. Yep, there's a picture.
Using the analysis that's in the textbook. So this is an extended version of GPA, where after you've got the landmarks all nicely positioned, you average the curves, put some evenly spaced points on those curves, doesn't have to be the same number in every curve, and proceed to warp that evenly spaced set of points onto each curve in turn. And that gives you a picture that looks like this, and you can see that there's the curves are represented by sets of dots now that are kind of lined up. So you can do a Procrustes analysis of that picture, the right-hand picture, using the standard GPA software, the software you've got. And that's how you should think of this. Bringing in semi-landmarks is a way of modifying your original data that has points and curves so that Procrustes thinks of it as just having points.
So George. I thought I heard you say both that you did not need the same number of points on each curve and that you did.
You don't need the same number of points on the forehead as you need on the back of the head. But each forehead has to have the same number of points.
And the spacing of those points
is arbitrary, but even is good.
But then when you're doing two curves, mm-hmm. do you have to, in some sense, put the points on the second curve in particular places dictated by where the points are on the first curve?
They're dictated by where the points are on the average of the curves. This is an iterative method. So you start with curves. You sample them kind of equally, although if they're typically curving sharply somewhere, it's best to have the points a little denser there. You average those and then warp that average into each specimen, allowing them to slide to the least bent positions. That's all in the text.
So there's a technology there for dictating where those points go.
And this idea is, if you're keeping track of the history, this idea is from 1997, its first publication, as a method. Its first appearance in anthropology was 1999, which is very fast. It was applied to a data set very much like this one, just foreheads, but otherwise a data set just very much like this one, where it worked wonderfully in picking out the fact that the brow ridge was behaving quite differently from the outside of the forehead behaving quite differently from the inside of the forehead in hominoid evolution. Here, we're skipping the details only because I want to assure you that if there's something intrinsically important about the curves in your data, then you can handle it within this general family. And the name of the technique is semi-landmarks. The name is from John Kent, who said, these things aren't landmarks because they're allowed to slide freely in the direction my mouse is moving. They really only have one coordinate, not two, so let's call them semi. And the name stuck. If you're in 3D, there are two kinds of semi-landmarks. There are semi-landmarks that are on a surface, like your forehead itself, so they can slide in two directions. And there are semi-landmarks that lie on curves, like the suture up the middle of the forehead. So they only slide in one, the metopic suture. So they only slide in one direction. And we call those, helpfully, surface semi-landmarks and curved semi-landmarks. And the programs, some programs like the Evan toolkit, will handle both of those cases. And 3D Edgework handles both of those cases. I haven't shown you that. So if your data looks like this, there's no problem. You just find the software. No one expects you to write the software. If you only have one moving point, after a little bit of geometry, you can actually figure out where it goes. And I'm showing you this from page 142 of the book because back in Vienna, when any student uses semi-landmarks, I reserve the right to ask them to show me this at their thesis defense. Even if you have 500 semi-landmarks, it is possible to explain where one of them goes if you only had one. And that's in the text here. Corresponding to this side of figure 572. If only one semi-landmark is sliding, then suppose it's sliding on a line like the tangent to the curve. The position it ends up in, according to the thin plate spline, is the place where that line is closest to where the landmark would have been given the spline on all of the others. And this is intuitively comprehensible. The sliding is trying to put each point as close as it can to where it would be if you weren't restricting it to the curve. If it was just entirely missing data, you put it down where your standard tells you to put it, and the sliding puts it as close to that as it can, given this line. And that I can demonstrate, if you're interested, over here. Let me bring this back. Let me put on a sliding landmark then, which is this, I think. Yeah. Okay, so here's a landmark that can go anywhere on that line. There's a curve here. So if I move it this way, I'm dragging the surface. If I move it this way, it's not sliding, or it's staying where it was. As I rotate this, it's actually going around in a circle, that yellow point, always trying to get as close as it can to where it would like to be if there wasn't any data about it at all, if it actually came from here. See, that's now a uniform transformation. But now I'm making, sorry, where's one? Now I'm forcing it not to be that free. So none of these are uniform. And what the semi-landmarks are doing is this computation for as many sliding points at once as you happen to have. So the algebra is kind of ugly. And in fact, this can slow a computer down if you have 500 points sliding all at the same time. But the principle is easy. It's putting the point in the place that implies the least change in your report, if your report is from a thin plate spline. So that's another kind of data to be aware of the possibility of. What's interesting is that when you do that, see, I'm going to page 147 here. When you do that, when you change, here's the average for the 22 humans, that picture I'm pointing to, when I add the curving points. Before we had an average of just the 20 landmarks. Now we have the total of 94 points there. There are 20 landmarks and 74 of these sliders. And yeah, that looks a hell of a lot more like a section through the middle of a calva than it looked like before we had the curves. But the curves don't add much information to the analysis. And this was a surprise. It came out from a postdoc, Stanislav Katina, who was in Vienna 15 years ago or so. He's now the professor of mathematical statistics at Brno in the Czech Republic or in Slovakia. I forget which country it is. Brno is where Gregor Mendel was.
Czech Republic.
Thank you. So it's where he's down the block from Gregor Mendel's grave. And he noticed that when you add these curves, you don't much change the things that we're doing with report structure. So let's see. So here, for instance, is the... No, I think I've got these backwards. Okay, yeah. So this is an analysis of the shape of those 22 skulls as we had it at the end of the example. I think it was in section 5.3, where we were throwing away the Neanderthals, throwing away the chimpanzees. So this is a scatter plot you've seen before. And here are the infants, 2-year-old, 4-year-old, 4-year-old, and here are the adults, and here's that one 25,000-year-old fossil. So you've seen this scatter plot before. This is shape. This is form space, the thing that also has size in it, because if you're studying these skulls, it's nice to keep size. And that was an option we talked about in chapter 5.4. So here's the analysis with all the curving information in and with size in. And here's the analysis you saw before without the curving information, but still with size in. And these are practically the same, including the curves, which was a lot of work. Doesn't change your understanding of the data. Here are the three young infants, 4, 2, and 4.
Here they are here. We've slightly altered the plot. Here's the 17-year-old and the 14-year-old at the bottom. Here's the 17-year-old and the 14-year-old at the bottom. Here's the 15th adult, 15th adult, first adult, first adult, fifth adult, fifth adult. You see what I'm doing.
I'm showing you that these two pictures are very nearly the same ordination. Ironically, the way you quantify that is with a Procrustes analysis that treats each of those points as a landmark, and you look for the Procrustes distance between those two pictures at the bottom. And the answer is they're not very different. So all the work of including the curves didn't make much difference. And this is a within-species analysis, if you believe that archaic Homo is a species. If you did this with Neanderthals in, you'd find some additional curving information. The back of the head of the Neanderthal has a bun, and the brow ridge is different. If you went on to chimpanzees, you'd find a lot more information from the curving, like an even bigger brow ridge and protruding maxilla that's picked up by a curve. But it isn't obvious that using curves benefits you more than, say, doubling your sample size. So especially if you're studying a restricted range of variation, it might be better just to go out and get more samples than to be really careful about taking curves from your data. And that, I guess, is the last point in section 5.5, the last thing I want to talk about on the splines. We can hit the bullets, and there's one more section coming. Bullets. The thin plate spline is a robust and very broadly applicable formula that gives you a transformation grid, which turns out to be, in my opinion, the best way of conveying most of the statistics we're talking about to a lay reader, which doesn't mean a reader without a PhD, it means a reader who hasn't taken morphometrics. People have been reading these grids probably for 30,000 years. They tend to get them correctly. Yeah, you have this text in your handout on the website. You can draw one of these grids for any computation in shape space, any multivariate analysis that gives you a linear formula, a mean difference, a factor, a principal component, a discriminant function, whatever. The verbal description of the thin plate spline is the grid that has the least bending energy of any mapping consistent with the landmarks you've got. Bending energy is an integral of sum of squares of second derivatives, and while this isn't elastic energy, it is actually the bending energy of a thin metal plate. The formula that's being used here comes from physics. It's the physics of a bending thin metal plate, a very large one in a world without gravity. So we didn't invent this. The physicists invented it. We're just using it. Remarkably, the bending energy is a quadratic form in the data, meaning you can use all the matrix machinery. You don't need to ever solve a partial differential equation. If there isn't any bending, we call it a uniform shear, and we already handled it in section 5.2. That's what the tensor, the shape change tensor, the circle to ellipse, was for. So the eigenanalysis of the bending energy matrix gives you a set of directions according to which your sample deviates from the Procrustes sphere. And at the very end, we'll get to it today, that same proposition can be stated using the word deflation twice. The eigenvectors with respect to deflated bending energy are a representation of how your sample shows patterns different from the self-scaling of this figure that we started with today. Okay, so let's now finish all the main examples. And this really is the end of the stable core of morphometrics. From here, you go to open research questions, like, for instance, what to do with missing data. Just sent Joe the bad news last night that for missing data, there are a variety of reasonable techniques that get you all different answers. There is no standard approach to missing data. The results are a function of what are your assumptions, and by the way, all of those also require a phylogenetic correction, which you were too polite to mention
well,
to me.
Because it's not the main issue. It's not the main issue. It's a complication.
Yeah.
But if you had if you had a sufficiently parametric model of what was going on, and you used either likelihood or Bayesian machinery, that would dictate to you what to do about the missing
if
data.
If the model is true, and that's the important
Well,
clause.
Whenever if one uses a model, the model is definitely true.
Oh, I didn't know that.
No, reality is to be
reality
assumed.
Is in
it
the
is
mind.
To be assumed that if reality does not cooperate, that's reality's problem and not yours.
You know, he means that, but that's okay.
So this last section, 5.6, has eight different subsections, and a typical project won't use all eight. These are here as a sort of smorgasbord, a banquet table, from which you can pick and choose depending on what you need for your particular study. But these are all things that people have done with the thin plate spline along with all of the other techniques we've seen.
So the first thing, as it says, a geometric morphometric analysis is a selection from the menu we've seen previously. You will end up, if you use this stuff, producing way more diagrams than you can possibly put into a dissertation, let alone into a paper. There is nothing wrong with that. You could, one project I was just working on a few months ago generated 960 PostScript pages of pictures and data, from which my job was to select about five that carried the message to an audience that consisted of lawyers. And they were grateful for the 960 to be boiled down to five. For a dissertation, you might have 15. For a published paper, they might give you five. Or you might get lucky, and for some of these examples, there might be one picture that carries it all. But don't demand that. It's just a possible finding. So the first thing we want to look at is your data. Splines for data screening. And I think I showed you this picture once already. Well, I didn't, because that's not the whole picture. This is the picture I showed you once already. This is the 29-form data set that we were using when we started talking about this mid-sagittal skull section. You remember, there are some babies, 2-year-old, 4-year-old, 4-year-old, 10-year-old, 14, 17, male and female chimpanzee, Australopithecus, 4 Neanderthals here, and then a bunch of adult humans. And if one of your data points is wrong, it will just leap out from this page as a tangle in the grid. It turns out that for one of these children, I've forgotten which one, two of these landmarks were reversed, and the grid tied itself in a knot, because that's what grids do when two points are reversed. It folds the grid, and your eye picks that up instantly back here. Let me make this a real point. That didn't work. Oh, I have to do it over here. It's a real point now. Here's another landmark, and I digitized these out of order. Can you tell that something is wrong? Yes, you can. That's not a biological change, that one on the right. Organisms don't fold. So if that's what your grid looks like, you go back and just number your landmarks, and something was digitized out of order or your algorithm blew it. But this is by far the easiest way to see that you have landmarks out of order. You just put them up on a page. Your eye is doing all the work for you. You don't need numbers, you just need a retina.
Fred, is there folding going on down in the chimps? Is that
yeah.
What I'm seeing
there? There actually is, and that's because we already talked about it. The inion here, these two points, have rearranged, have gotten so far apart that the grid is folding past them. Let me zoom in on that so you can see the distinction. Good for you.
So in phylogenetically distinct groups.
Yeah, this one just manages not to fold, the female. The male is folding, but if you look closely, you can see it's folding outside of the form. So the spline doesn't sensibly extrapolate. It is for interpolation only. Something is going on here in the air outside the chimpanzee's skull, and we don't want to actually talk about that as biology. But it's good of you to see that.
It seems like you could also have instances in development where points might migrate past each other.
Oh, right? 2 points. First, if you study development from an early enough stage,
everything.
Well, if you study the development of the mouse heart, for instance, which I have a paper on, two points start in the same place and grow apart, and the spine can't handle that. You can't move one point into two. You have to run it backward, and you can watch a spine collapse into a line, and that's a method that is mentioned somewhere in here. It's called the method of creases. I can't remember if it, oh, it's coming. So, yes, you, if two points came from the same place or wildly expand, you run the same thing in reverse because it's more tractable visually done that way than the other. And again, I can show that here. Let me undo this. Clear, relax, please. Thank you. So here, if I run those way apart, I get something that really looks kind of weird. And it has a different effect if I just move those, it's a similar effect if I move those together. I get a local deformation of the grid that's not trustworthy. But if I go in the other direction, it's much more trustworthy. So this is just practical lore. But good point, Cooper. So this is data screening or general thinking about whether you want to use a particular deformation model rather than trust it. Here's an example. We're continuing on. Oops, let me get back to where we were. Slow me down if you have any questions about any of these examples, because that means you might want to use it, and that's a reason to slow down. But I'm just pulling from the textbook. So number two, splines for comparing two things. That's how we taught it at the beginning. We go way back to the very first picture here, the very first one of these pictures in the book, I think it was in the book, it was known as the chapter, so I don't want to reset that, it's too hard. Whoops, that didn't work. So I go back here to page, I think it was about 400. You remember this example. This is our first in-plate spline way back on part one of chapter one. Here's a human skull. Here's a chimpanzee skull. It's got the curves on it, so it's 94 points each. It's like what we were just talking about. And here's the grid between them, human to chimpanzee. So this is a valid use of thin plate spine. You can also run this in the opposite direction. Chimpanzee to human, the maxilla will be shorter and the brain will be larger. These are almost exactly vector opposites. Not quite, but almost. So back here, which is somehow clogged. There we go. Yeah. Oops. Okay, that's fine. Back here.
Sorry, question.
Yeah?
Are they not vector opposites because the center is determined by the Procrustes center of the point thread?
No, that's not Procrustes. They're not vector opposites because the spline is a function of the starting form, and it's a nonlinear function of the starting form. According to the formulas, you're inverting that matrix L, and L is a function of the distances between the landmarks that you started with. And if the forms are sufficiently different, they will look like they're not inverses.
Back here when we were working on this, if I swapped these two, well, I could. So here, if I swapped those two, that doesn't look like the inverse of the grid we had before. Because there's a nonlinearity here and a nonlinearity here, they're different. But that's considered beyond the bounds of reasonable applications of this technique. The people who use this without looking use a criterion of Procrustes distance between the forms. That's not right. It's actually the rearrangement of the smallest feature or form that governs whether you can use a thin plate spline. It's not the biggest, it's the smallest. So that was just a mistake that Les Marcus made 20 years ago that unfortunately got programmed. Okay, splines for pairwise contrasts. So this is the average. This is the average of the three babies from that sample of skulls. It's not very many, and it's being mapped to the average of
the 16 adults. So we left out the adolescents. We don't know if they're children or adults. Here's the forward grid, children to adults. And here is the inverse. So this is adults to children. And that's the opposite transformation. If I've got it right here. No, that isn't right.
Doesn't look like it.
Yeah, this is, that's just two rotations of the same figure. That's, okay, that's just wrong. I have to fix that. That's just a mistake, sorry. So, leaving that alone, did I already fix that somewhere? Yeah, never mind. Anyhow, this is the same pattern rotated about 45 degrees. The grid doesn't attach to the form. The grid can rotate over the form. So here this line is vertical, and here this line is at about 45 degrees, and you get the same impression. And I'm sorry I didn't reverse it for you. That definitely does have to be fixed. Fix 577. Let me... give me a minute, because I think I have fixed that. Just a moment. I think there's a new figure 577 somewhere. Let's try 575. Or 576. Okay, well, I can't seem to find what I'm remembering having computed. So we'll skip that. But indeed, that's the same grid twice, not the grid in its opposite. Another thing that's useful to do, maybe it was on the homework analysis. Another thing that's useful to do is to extrapolate those grids till you can read them. So this was an instruction in the homework problem I gave you. That's weird, as it's in the homework. Excuse me a moment. Biology UW Bio 550, 2016. Still can't find it. 534. Never mind. This, in the homework exercise I gave you, there's an instruction on how to double a transformation, meaning run the same starting form and twice as much shape change, or any such number, by fiddling around with the target form, essentially by doubling its vector distance from the starting form. So this is twice the previous grid. And now its features are fairly clear. This is twice that previous grid, twice this previous grid. You can see much more clearly the brain has gotten smaller. Maxilla has gotten bigger, but mostly longer. This is fair for the purposes of reporting. You report the actual comparison, and then you say, to understand the features of this change better, we simply extrapolate it by a factor of 2 or whatever is convenient. And there's some more of these coming, some more of these factors. This is fair. You just keep track of the fact that you did multiply it by 2. This is twice as much growth as from child to adult, some sort of hypermorphosis. This is the same, twice as much growth. So that's something you can do. It's still two forms, but now we're making it easier to talk about what changed by making the effect bigger till you can read it, you and the reader. Here's the rats. This is age 7 to 14, the transformation we were talking about a little while ago. That's mostly uniform. And I told you the non-uniformity was localized to where my mouse is. And it was hard to see. It's easy to see if you multiply it by 5.
That is not cheating. That is teaching. You have to say times 5 when you produce the picture.
Here's 14 to 21 times 5, 21 to 30 times 5, 30 to 40, 40 to 60, 60 to 150, sorry, 60 to 90, 90 to 150. And here's 7 to 150, the whole range. And now this is only doubled, because if I multiplied it by 5, it would fold. You've already got somewhere in the book this transformation at natural scale. Actually, we talked about it last time. It's somewhere in this chapter. But this is how you say this is clearly getting shorter. This is growing lengthwise, this anteroposteriorly faster than that. This is a square trapezoid transformation. And something is going on here. That will be the report. And one of the important things to notice is I told you 3 things, even though there are only 2 principal components in this data set. Principal components is not a biological technique. It actually comes from psychology. And you can have a lot more things in heaven and earth, Horatio, than are talked about in your philosophy. You can have way more features of shape change than are detected by a principal component analysis. It turns out this is going to have 4 out of 2 principal components. The principal components are irrelevant to the biology. They are relevant to the ordination if you're trying to sort. But here we know what age each rat is. We're not trying to sort. So this is, we're still in section 5.6.2 here, on page 153. This is an extension of group mean comparisons, because each of these is a comparison of 2 averages. Average 7 to average 14, or average 7 to average 150. And this technique of extrapolation is actually pretty useful. I use it all the time. Next topic, this is number 3 out of 8, splines for regressions. Instead of a 2-group comparison, we can draw a regression of shape on something. Now, a regression of shape on something is actually the regression of each Procrustes shape coordinate on something. Those are more robust than the usual Procrustes procedure, because they're less sensitive to all of those problems with Procrustes that we were talking about. Those regressions don't have the problems of the wrong principal components, for instance. And especially if you draw the regression as a spline, you don't have this problem of the centroid staying fixed, getting the wrong impression for things growing apart. So here, starting on page 155, are a couple of examples. Okay, there's an inversion for you. Over here, this is the effect of larger size, which is pretty much the same thing as child versus adult, but it's computed as a regression instead of a group mean difference, and that's a good idea because there were only 3 children being averaged there, but there are a lot of small heads. So we can make our smaller, we can get away from this limitation to 3 babies by doing a regression. So here's the regression toward larger size, and nobody's surprised, smaller brain, bigger maxilla, mostly horizontally. And now, finally, I get to flip the regression for you. This is the opposite regression. I just reversed the signs of every change vector, every regression slope. And now, as you get younger, or as you become a human, you get a bigger brain and a smaller maxilla, especially horizontally. And this is called the effect of straightening the face, reducing the camper angle. Camper lived in the 18th century and was the first person to measure the fact that the muzzle of chimpanzees protrudes farther than the muzzle of human beings. We have a basically flat face, and the other apes don't. So this is an old finding that's just been confirmed here. Not a surprise. We can go a lot further than just the regression of centroid size here. We can run this for twice as far
or we can run it for 2.5 times as far. Those previous graphs were the range of size in the data. And here I've run it until it folds. And you can see that it has folded pretty much in the same place all at the same time. This has a name in human craniofacial biology. That's called the hafting zone. A haft is the way the head of an axe fits onto a handle. And here it's the way the neural skull fits onto the face, or vice versa. And if you want to draw a picture that says we have this in our data, the relative undergrowth of this part of the brain with respect to both the brain case and the maxilla, that's your picture. Then you want to run it backward. This is a really, really small baby with all brain, and the thing that goes away first is the palate. So the palate has the most negative allometry in the system, to use the terminology from a different field. And if any of you study fish, in fish growth, the eye has the most negative allometry. It grows slower than any other part of the fish. And other genera of organisms have similar patterns. This is how you show those patterns. It's how you show allometry instead of just talking about it. Okay. Moving on, because this is a smorgasbord. Every principal component you might compute on the Krusty's coordinates, those are called relative warps, by the way. I invented the name back 25 years ago, and everybody uses it. Relative warps are the thin plate spline or the principal components of the Krusty distance that underlie them. And those get pictures. So here, I think I showed you this before, instead of the regression on size, and instead of the children versus adults, this is the relative warp analysis. This is the first relative warp of those forms. On the picture we were using before, earlier today, it's the horizontal component of this plot, the first principal coordinate. But similar, yeah. This is forward, and we've seen that before. But now we've gotten it three different ways. Another message here. Don't show your reader all three of these. Show your reader whichever one of these is the clearest for what you want to talk about, and then say the other two approaches give you the same figure. To do that, you have to look at all three, but your reader does not. It is often the case here that, especially if the signal is strong, different approaches will give you the same report. Then pick the one that is most elegant, so or most informative.
Yeah. Your relative warp, your first relative warp, or first component, is showing you the long term changes. If you had specimens ordered,
if this was a growth series, they'd be the long term changes. This is a sample of all Homo sapiens, so it is a growth
and,
series.
And the later ones, perhaps you'll show us. I don't know.
This is the later one. This is the second one.
Okay, is showing you things that might be nonlinear and go first this way and then.
No, they're still linear. They're not correlated. These are uncorrelated aspects that are probably parabolic.
There's something like parabolic with something
time.
Time.
Right. Yep.
So they are showing you something that's going this way and then back again.
In this particular example, we've already said that second principal component isn't statistically significant. I'm drawing it to say that the text says so far. If it was real, it would be vertical growth of the maxilla. But it isn't real, not in this sample. However, or
at least you don't have a big enough sample size to prove it's real.
Exactly right. Nicely phrased. Yeah, I'll put a page in my thought here. Okay, so that's, again, what you do. As soon as you compute principal components of shape, as soon as I compute principal components of shape, these relative warps, I always draw them like this in both directions, because these are the same relative warp viewed forward or viewed backward, and the report can have both of those. As you get bigger, the brain gets relatively smaller, the maxilla gets relatively longer forward. Or, as you get smaller, as you approach human status, the brain gets relatively larger, the maxilla gets relatively shorter. That's worth telling a reader, that you can reverse these descriptions by reversing the direction of the phenomenon.
still in section 4. What's the next example here? Oh, here's the same thing for the rats. This is the first principle. Oh, this actually matches Joe's point precisely. This is the first principal component for the rats. It looks pretty much like the mean change from age 7 to 150. You saw this before. Here's the opposite, what it's like to become a baby rat. It is exactly like what Steve Gould said is involved in becoming a baby car, a Volkswagen. This is the Volkswagen rat. Big windshield, vertical grille, short car. This is the heterochrony of rat growth, and it works for cars as well. Here's the second principal component for the rats, which is real. First going backward, then going forward in terms of a shear. Both pretty nearly uniform. We'll come back to this at the very end, what this thing is actually doing. So this is the second principal component, but the first two of our four features in the final list. So this principal component turns into two features, one for the large scale, one for the small scale. And this principal component turns into two features, one for the first half, one for the second half. You're not supposed to, you're not allowed to call that principal component analysis anymore. That is biology. You're taking apart the principal components to make good explanations. What's coming next? Okay. You don't need landmarks to do this. Here's a data set that is dear to my heart, because the finding was that people working on this in the 1920s had gotten it right. And because that was the finding, it was not publishable in the anthropology journals or the journals of feet. We had to publish it in PLOS One, which is a place you pay $1,500 to publish your article. But this was a really neat study, again, confirming something we already knew. Study of 160 footprints of adult women, students at the University of Zagreb, imaged in 3D and then cut two millimeters above the floor, so you get a 2D footprint, sort of like the outline in sand. Here are the two standard measures from the 1920s. There's the ratio of these two dotted lines, that's called the arch index, how short this is with respect to that, and the angle of this line with respect to the outside edge, that's called the arch angle. Here are the first two principal components of the 160 footprints treated as 36 sliding landmarks. No fixed landmarks. Everything sliding around. There's no requirement here. They are close enough to the same family that the algorithm still works. Here's PC1. Here's PC2. Here's a picture superimposed over the front and the back of the shoe. And PC1 turns out to look just like changing, just like the sum of these two measures. And PC2 turns out to look just like the difference. And this is important if you're building shoes, it turns out. If you want to know how to build an arch support, it only has two dimensions, plus scale. So that's an example, using relative warps, interpreting them in terms of standard language, and no landmarks at all. And there's also a paper about these for the evolution of Baculites, if you care about the sorts of creatures that Peter Ward in the next building cares about. Baculites is one of these spiral ammonites that had a very clear punctuated equilibrium that you pick up by an analysis like this without any landmarks. Here's something that we touched on a couple of days ago. You can use this for motion. You can use this for art by carefully picking your starting form and then following it up. This was done offline, statically, for the analysis, but it can now be done online. And this is frames from a 5-minute dance. Do I have the moving version of that on screen on the system? Yes, I think I do. Give me a moment, because this is really pretty. Here we go. I think that's gorgeous. And of course, this took some work, needless to say. But this is the dance.
And you can see the dancer. W.B. Yeats would be delighted. How do you tell the dancer from the dance? By color on the grid. This runs for about a minute and a half. But let me run it, because this has nothing to do with biology, but everything to do with your retinas and your brain and the reason the thin plate spline works. Here's that glorious freeze frame that I love so.
Well, it has to do with the ways a body can move.
No, it has to do with your perception of grids. You are seeing that grid, and the dancer is coming in and out. Yes, you know how a body moves, but you're also following a grid. The grid is moving smoothly. This is the freeze frame I'm so proud of. And then it continues. Joe is, of course, right that you also know how people dance, but the grid is doing the work here. You're watching it fold. The dancer isn't folding. The grid is folding. Anyhow, this tends to grab audiences by the throat and not let go. If you can draw your evolution this way, you have a winner at the museum. You're projected on the wall. This was the core of a display at the Vienna Museum of Natural History, not to restore a show, a year ago, in a display of the tools of science. This was a two-minute run of the tool of morphometrics, not from an evolutionary example, just for the power of the graphics. Okay, running out of time here, but I like that. The things you can carry around on a computer with you. That would be a difficult project. Anyway, continuing on with the book here, we've got 18 stills for you to choose from. Because I just picked them because I thought they were pretty. So we're still in section 5.4. 5.6.4. Here's a nicely folded grid. Here it's lying down, and here we get back to the beginning. It's where he ended. Okay. Splines for the partial warps. You remember we have this language for features belonging only to the mean of large, medium, and small scale. Those have grids. And you can draw them as grids at the same time you draw them as scatters. Here's our rat example. This is the zeroth partial warp, the uniform term. And you can see the rat is getting shorter but shearing backward for the first part of its growth, and still getting shorter but shearing forward for the second part. So this has two grids, and we've already seen them in terms of that second principal component. Here's the largest scale feature, which will turn out to be part of the final report. Notice it's only one dimension here. And it has less variance than the uniform term. Even less variance for the second one of these, which is a different pattern of curving. Even less variance for kind of S-curve for the third one. Even less for the fourth one. These turn out not to be independent characters. And then more variance and homogeneous, one-dimensional, for the fifth one, which is this thing we've been looking at a lot. So this starts to give you hints that will end up driving the method of integration, which is my last topic. But this, again, is a standard way of looking to see, do we have a lot of uniform variation? Yeah, early on. Yes, overall. Large scale, less medium scale, less small medium scale, even less medium small scale, and then more at the very last scale. Something local is happening. This is a very useful way for you to learn what kinds of patterns are likely to be there. You just look at that picture, scatters and warps. Here's a blow-up of the uniform term with the rats connected. So you can see all rats are doing roughly the same thing here. First relative warp, all doing roughly the same thing. Second one, all doing roughly the same thing. Youngest rats, middle-aged, adult, cluster. Youngest, middle-aged, adult, cluster. Youngest, middle-aged, adult, cluster. Strongly correlated growth pattern over the scales. It's what we call integration. It means there will eventually be one report here. We don't yet know quite what it's going to say. Another analysis, splines for partial least squares. I'll be quick here. If you have external variables that are supposed to drive a shape change or be driven by a shape change, you can do an analysis of, it's in the text in chapter 4, a part we skipped, you can do an analysis of the part of shape that is most covarying with these causes or effects. Here it's the shape of the corpus callosum, an example we saw briefly, and it is highly correlated, highly covarying with a pattern of either motor deficits or executive function deficits in these alcohol-damaged adult males. Executive function deficits get you thrown in jail. It's a pattern of callosa that looks sort of like this. It's backing off from the frontal lobe, which is where you think about what you're doing. Motor deficit is just thin back here in the corpus callosum. The motor centers are here, and you're clumsy, but you're not criminal. The numbers on the plot are IQ, showing that this distinction is independent of IQ. This was published about 15 years ago. So it's an old analysis. But if you're trying to predict form variation by its causes or its effects, we have a technique for you. And it gives you linear variables that are then presented as grids. If you want to use this within the world of form, here's the maxilla as a polygon, a pentagon. Here's the brain case as a hexagon. You can compute the aspect of maxillary shape that's most covarying as a shape factor with brain case shape. This is an analysis. It answers the question, what part of the maxillary shape is most covarying with brain shape, which is a useful question about evolution. And the facial part is extension of the length of the maxilla, and the brain case part is a shape feature that we're looking at, and their correlation here is about minus 0.7. Here's a cautionary tale. Okay, first, this is very close to relative warp 1 of that combination of itself. This looks like that, this looks like that. But more to the point, this is a nice modern analysis, and I kept on saying shape, because there's also size, and people talked about size for years. And so we could talk about the part of shape here that is allometric, because we know how to do that. That's what's talked about here in some section of the text. Where can I find where? Did I skip the formulas? The formulas are in the matrix part that we skipped in section 5.4. But you could actually ask, this is fine about shape, but suppose I ask just a simpler question. The allometric shape here, how do those correlate between the brain case and the face? And this is actually a picture of allometric brain size, this thing with the dashes, and allometric maxilla size, and those two variables correlate 0.83. So the lesson here is, just because you get a finding and it has an interpretation in terms of the maxilla getting bigger than the brain getting smaller, don't stop. Look for other possible analyses from this toolkit that can clarify, strengthen, otherwise simplify, make it easier to write about your finding. And this is also better because the infants now separate. They didn't on the previous example. This will look mysterious to you now only because you haven't seen the matrix algebra. We skipped over it. But if you need it, it's somewhere in the book, according to the cross-references. There's an analysis of symmetry and asymmetry. This is historically important. People have talked about the use of asymmetry as an indication of developmental stress, both in vertebrates and in insects. So it's a measure of environmental degradation. So this is now practical, applied entomology. And there's a standard Procrustes approach that I invented maybe 20 years ago, and that Cantimardia reduced to theorems in a paper of 2000 that is almost his most cited paper. And this is a picture from the teaching program of that. It's out in every package now, so if you need to draw the symmetric part of something, the left-right difference that you don't much care about, you can. Or you can draw the difference between left and right. This is looking at human faces from the front, magnifying the left-right mean difference by 10. Our left face is, on the average, larger than our right face. Sorry, got it backwards. Right face is larger than left face. We're looking at the face from the front. and it's directional. It's larger, more mediolaterally than it is craniocaudally. And this is a really good picture for a stable phenomenon. This is a directional asymmetry of the human head. There's also directional symmetry of the human brain in a different plane.
And again, that's a two-dimensional figure. It is not a surface curving backwards.
Actually, this is a three-dimensional data set. I'm drawing a two-dimensional section of a three-dimensional grid. That is a curving grid in space.
It's curving back away.
It's curving backwards.
Oh, so really
I'm drawing
it.
Okay. I'm drawing it in projection.
Does that mean that the points on the right side aren't just getting on the left side aren't just getting squashed together, but they're moving back?
They're drifting a little backward, but they're mostly getting squashed.
Yeah.
Yeah. This isn't a flat surface, okay. But the normal description of directionality is the description of that picture, okay. Not of the solid corresponding. Okay. That's symmetrization, and here's an example. You can use that likewise for moving landmarks. So here's a face with some landmarks and some curves on it, and you can symmetrize that. This is now exactly flat. It's for a study of perceived health of faces, and there's a strong signal in data like this for perceived health, and it isn't remotely the same as the signal for actual health. You could ask people, how healthy does a face look? And they give you the wrong answer compared to the BMI, for instance, body mass index, which is the best predictor. And now finally, that method of integration I've been telling you about, mentioning, this is the newest part of this book. It's from last year. Those partial warps that we had back, how many pages ago? Partial warps here from this picture, each one has a variance. And for the truly self-similar model that I was showing you in this picture, those variances are strictly a function of the bending energy of the warp, essentially the spacing, the landmarks involved. Each variance is 1 over the corresponding bending energy, which means if you plot those, partial warp 1, partial warp 2, partial warp 3, partial warp 4, for a transformation that doesn't have any localizable signal, you get a straight line with a slope of minus 1. That isn't this. This is a straight line with a slope of minus 1.5, meaning those warps are losing variance faster than self-similar, meaning this is an integrated transformation. More things are happening at large scale than small scale, with the exception of this last point, which we kept on making an exception. So if you want to talk about this as an integrated process, which it is, it's the whole rat that's growing, you take that seriously in the following way. You compute what we were just showing here as the distributions that are self-similar. So here's that curve for the Procrustes, and here's that curve for this distribution. And this one is flat. Every scale has the same variance. And this one goes down by minus 1. For little squares to have the same null performance as big squares, this has to be the slope, minus 1, which is a specific number. It's not different from 0. It's the minus 1. And here's the proof in your book that in that distribution, different size squares have the same shape variance. So this then becomes a data processing technique. You can use it, and I'll just show you it for the rats. There are some more examples in this 2015 paper I was talking about, if anybody wants it. But if you apply that to the rats, it turns out you find one dimension of integration, which turns out to be the quadratic growth gradient we were looking at, mostly a combination of partial warp 1 and partial warp 2, but only one dimension. And then something special going on in partial warp 5, the last one, which is the difference between this, the quadratic gradient, and this is what we actually get. And you can see, yeah, there's more going on here. than just the large-scale stuff. And so you can put that all together, finally, and this is the last picture in the book, thank God, as the four-feature report of the two principal component version of the growth of these 18 rats. So this is the biology I'm claiming of a data set that's now, the data set is now more than 30 years old. There have been dozens of papers on this data set for morphometric purposes. Originally the data is from Melvin Moss. But here's the first part of the uniform transformation. I think it's magnified by a factor of 2. And here's the second part, similarly getting shorter but shearing in the other direction, so two different things happening. Here the rat is nursing, here the rat is chewing, probably makes a difference for cranial biomechanics. Here's the large-scale, medium-scale growth gradient, only one dimension, and here's that specific thing at factor at principal warp 5, the smallest scale, linear in time like everything else, but a completely separate process geometrically. That's just warping the grid down here. And if you apply this to the growth of the... If you apply this to the mosquito wing data, you get an informative analysis. You apply this to my data on corpus callosum of people with fetal alcohol syndrome, you get the null model. You apply this to the human skull data, you get the null model. Self-similar growth. No meaningful features in that human sample. Just roughly the same amplitude of change at every scale. Yes, one principal component, but it's distributed evenly across the scales. It looks like brain versus face because brain versus face are at the opposite ends of a diameter. This is interesting that that transformation doesn't modularize. Not geometrically. It does embryologically, and that's worth saying. The brain and the face are controlled by different embryonic tissues. But you can't tell this from geometry. Those are examples in the paper. We have come to the end of the book here. This is the end of section 5.6.8. I'll be here for 3 more of the lectures, but I wanted to make sure you've seen the fact that each of these is a possible component of a report. No analysis will ever use all of them. No thesis will ever show more than a fraction of the pictures you compute. No published papers will even have a fraction of what the thesis shows. But you have the tools to make visual, to make communicable a pretty broad variety of geometric aspects, morphometric aspects of biological processes. And one of these is phylogeny, which is the transition to the rest of the course.
Well,
sorry.
What I would like to do, you will not be, present next Tuesday?
I'm not here next Tuesday.
You're not around. But what I will do is, I want to do 2 things. One is start with a discussion, really, with you of how to deal with data at different sort of levels, including ranging from within individuals to between populations to phylogenies, and make sure that everybody is reasonably on the same page there. And then I'll be starting out on doing some material on how natural selection with adaptive surfaces comes in or does not come in
comes over
to the models that we use on phylogenies. But I thought the discussion, the broader discussion, should start out because people are getting to their to dealing with their projects, and we should make sure we're okay with that before I go off onto more abstruse phylogenetic stuff.
It's not abstruse. It's just abstract in a different way.
Okay. Anyway, that's where we'll start.